You're listening to the WP Tonic, WordPress and Tech, focused on building a successful business in WordPress aimed at the WordPress professional and power user. Join Jonathan Denwood and Kurt Von Annen as your host and co-host as we bring you great discussions from around the globe.
Welcome back, folks, to the WP Tonic Show. This is episode 953. I think I might have done more episodes than the guest we've got on coming on the show, but I don't know. He runs a very popular podcast. I'm not sure if he's up to 953. I'm sure he will tell me. Hey, shaking his head, he probably is.
770, I think it recorded yesterday.
Oh, there's just one thing I've seen you on, behind it. Rob. There's nothing else that...
Hangs head in shame.
Yeah, I don't think you've got any much to worry about. We've got a friend of the show, Dr. Rowling, with us, the joint founder of Tiny Seed, a company that invests in bootstrap startups. He also is the founder of the popular podcast Startups for the Rest of Us. Plus, he does a load of other things. Got an amazing wife, got a nice family, he's done all right for himself. Yes, it's sickening, isn't it, folks? But somebody's got to work hard and be lucky, haven't they? But there we go, it ain't me. But I've accepted my fate, folks. I still live in the possibility. So there we go. Rob, you've got a new book out, haven't you? What's the book about, Rob?
Book is called Exit Strategy, The Entrepreneur's Guide. It's The Entrepreneur's Guide to Selling Your Business Without Regret. Co-authored it with said wife that you mentioned. And it's all about the mental and psychological process of thinking through selling your business. And then as you're going through it, and then once you've sold, how do you think about what's next?
Right. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about some of the podcasts and posts and videos that Rob has done over the last few months. We're going to discussing about how Rob sees how AI might affect the startup world, which also affects WordPress as well. We're also going to be talking about the freemium price model. I think in your video, you call it pricing strategy. It's disastrous. In capitals, we're going to be discussing that. Plus, we're probably going to be talking about his book as well. It should be a great show. Kurt, would you like to introduce yourself as well?
Sure. Kurt Von Annen, owner of Mañana No Más. We focus largely on membership and learning websites and working directly with WP Tonic and the good folks at Lifter LMS.
That's fantastic. Before we go into the meat and potatoes of this great interview, I've got a message from one of our major sponsors. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
Hi there, e-commerce store owner. At Omnisend, we help more than 100,000 e-commerce customers just like you sell their products. We're an all-in-one email and SMS marketing platform that helps you reach your customers, grow your audience, and increase sales. In fact, our customers have seen incredible results with Omnisend, averaging $72 in revenue for every single dollar spent. And if you ever have a question, our award-winning customer support team is available 24/7 every single day. That's one of the reasons we have more than 6,000 glowing reviews and ratings all across the web. So get started with Omnisend today and start growing your business with better email and SMS marketing.
We're coming back, folks. Before we go into the interview, I also want to point out we've got a great free resource for you WordPress power users, you freelancers. We've got a curated list of the best WordPress plugins and services that we have tested ourselves and we use on a daily, weekly, monthly, and yearly basis. It's a great resource. It will save you a ton of time. You can get this free resource by going over to wp-tonic.com/deals. wp-tonic.com/deals. Plus, there's some special deals from the sponsors. What more could you ask for, my beloved tribe? Probably a lot more, but that's all you're going to get from that page. They love me saying that, Rob, actually. I get more comments about that little statement than anything. I think I can get away with it because I'm English, aren't I? I can get away with that nonsense, can't I? So, Rob, obviously you've been on the show multiple times. You're a glutton for punishment, aren't you, Rob? You keep coming back for more, don't you? But you need that type of determination if you're an online entrepreneur, don't you, Rob? But can you give the tribe, the new listeners and viewers, and we've had quite a new load of new people lately, can you give us a quick intro of your background and how you got into the crazy world of online business building, Rob?
For sure. Yeah, software engineer is really how it all started. And working a day job, and as many people experience, just wasn't as fun as I wanted it to be. I am unemployable. That's what I now call myself.
Now you are. You're interviewing somebody that truly is unemployable, Rob.
Yeah.
You are. I'm not, Rob.
I worked several jobs, and I was really good as a developer. I would manage people, I would lead them, and I hated the job the whole time. And I pissed off my managers. I never got fired. I never was like disrespectful, but I just was so unhappy with the way things went. I hated the politics. I hated all that. So I started building little businesses on the side. 2003 was the first one I launched. Didn't work. 2004, launched another one. Didn't work. 2005, finally had a little bit of a success, and then, you know, kind of built it up from there. Stair-stepped my way up. I was blogging along the way about doing it, and I was like, it was me. I was the only one at the time. Well, Joel Spolsky was before me, and then I started. And then 2 years later, Patrick McKenzie, Patio 11 started. Peldy also started in 2007, I think. Jason Cohen in 2008 and 2009. Like, these were the kind of the bootstrapper. I know Jason Cohen's technically not a bootstrapper, but he really is he thinks like a bootstrapper, and he can talk to what we do. So that was it. And then at a certain point, I realized, man, I like building businesses, but I think I kind of like, as much as building them, I like talking about building them. And so that became the blog. And then I wrote a book in 2010. And then the podcast started for the rest of us. And I started a few SaaS apps after that. But I like to say I started 6 companies, 5 of them bootstrapped. I've written 5 books now on entrepreneurship.
Would you say building Drip and selling it was one of the biggest turning points for you and your family and your career? Really?
It was. Yeah. And it's interesting. I wanted to build my next thing. This is late 2012. And I was like, I want it to be 10 times bigger than the one before it. And just to see what it was like and to prove that I could a little bit to myself. And it turns out I could do it. And it turns out it was pretty tough. Having, you know, I didn't have all the expertise that I needed to do it, but we figured it out along the way. So we sold it in 2016. And that was the moment that I could have retired. I was like 40 years old, maybe. Somewhere in that range. And I took 6 months off after I left. But, you know, obviously folks like us are not, we're not retiring. We're going to keep cranking.
Well, you know, it's a playing golf all the time.
I got to be doing something, man. I would write books, podcasts.
Yeah, it's just laying on the beach, just deteriorating slowly and just playing golf. That didn't appeal to you, Rob.
Yeah, about a week. And then it's like, all right, what am I doing next?
God, that would be a snore fest, wouldn't it, Rob? You must be dead, won't you? There we go. Over to my fantastic. Old Kirk's laughing. He doesn't. I'm still surprised, old Kirk. He's been my co-host now for what, 2.5-3 years? There, it's gone quick.
It's gone quick for me.
I don't think it's gone so quick for you, Kirk.
I was just thinking, you know, if some people's definition of retirement would be laying on a beach or hanging out at state parks and making a podcast from the beach or from the park, right? Like, I just see things from a different perspective. But
you only got one life. Well, I actually think you got multiple, but that's more to do with me. But there we go. So over to you, Kurt. You got the next question.
Yeah. So obviously, Jonathan and I are both fans of the Startup for the Rest of Us podcast, and you discussed AI more than once, obviously, but you've
never invited me to the show, Rob.
You should show up. I showed up in Riverside and you just never came, so I recorded a solo episode instead.
Sorry, Kirk, I won't interrupt. He's never asked me, though. You're gonna have to hit. There we go. All right,
wait, nudge, animals.
I'm so subtle, I know, Rob.
So your thoughts on AI, like you portrayed it as possible threats, but also opportunities. And I think it's kind of like this little echo thing that some of us have. But how have your feelings on AI reshaped over time since talking about it on the show?
I think they've reshaped in the sense of, you know, the gestalt seems to be on social media that it's panic time and SaaS is dead and SaaS is over. And that hadn't happened when I recorded it. I think agents started becoming a thing, right? And so then, you know, here's the thing about the lack of subtlety on social media is it's either this new thing is going to totally kill X, let's just say SaaS, or it's going to have no impact on SaaS. And you know what? Neither of those is true. Just like with no code. Remember when no code came out? No more developers, no more SaaS. Everyone's going to build their own thing. It's like, no, that's not true. But also, let's not ignore no code because it has changed things, right? It has an impact. And maybe there's 10 or 20% fewer SaaS companies that need to be built or that can be sustained because no code allows, like my team at Tiny Seed Microconf, we have, I think, at least 3 or 4 full-blown kind of line of business apps that help us with like YouTube production and you know, podcast production that we, prior to this, we would have paid for a SaaS, but we just built them in Airtable in 2 weeks, right? So it is having an impact. Does it mean there's no more SaaS? SaaS can't exist. No, that's bullshit. And the same thing with agents and AI is there's so much FOMO around it. And it's people who want to be able to make a big headline and get it, it's engagement farming. So it's super annoying. So that is how I've become less subtle about it, where I was like, oh, let's look at the nuance of this. SaaS will change because of AI. And if you ignore it, you ignore it at your peril, basically. I think that people are developing faster using it. So if you're a developer, or you know, get your developers using it, because you can roll out features more quickly, integrate it into your day-to-day operations, et cetera, et cetera. But what I wasn't saying is, oh my gosh, it's, you know, it's going to end or it's not going to change anything. No, I'm just saying everyone kind of simmer down. SaaS will exist. Agents are not going to put SaaS out of business. In fact, I just recorded a YouTube video that goes live probably next week or the week after. That is exactly, it's like 15 minutes of me walking, trying to logically and sensibly walk through this rather than just throwing my hands up in the air and running around like the blow up doll in front of the used car lot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I just think about my own inbox, you know, and the 15 to 20 spam messages a day I get from some new fantastic AI product that's going to be the end of YouTube or something, right? And, but then on the other hand, I think about clients I interact with. And so many people's expectations of what AI is, or the hype that AI has presented. I mean, some of these people think we're literally in the days of enterprise. Like you go into the cafe at Enterprise and go, make me hot chocolate. And it goes, and there's a hot chocolate. Like that's not how the internet works, right? And it's, I think there's a big gap between what AI is really doing and what people envision it to do. And then what all these other like spammers are trying to tell us it's already doing that it doesn't do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, is the folks who are in it, like if you're in it day to day, and if you're using Windsurf or Cursor and you're using ChatGPT, I mean, gosh, I search at least 50% fewer searches on Google than I used to. And it's, I go to ChatGPT now. Yeah. I know it's less energy efficient. I don't really want that to be the case, but a lot of stuff is so possible. If you're in it, it's cool and you can see the possibilities, but you very quickly see the edges, which is what you're saying. There's a lot of edges and there's hallucinations have gotten better, but there's a lot of things it can't do and it doesn't do very well, like writing long form content. It's just very plain vanilla, right? It'll get better at that. But to your point, if you're in it, you see the edges. And if you're not in it, you think it's magic. Is kind of what my experience has been. And the answer is probably closer to somewhere in between, but it's closer to where you and I are, you know, if you're again in it a lot.
Nice, nice. Jonathan?
Yeah, I think I get the feeling it's a kind of a hybrid situation, because it seems to have elements of the early days of the internet before the boom bust. But it also has elements in the way it's coming across to me, Robert, of Bitcoin and that whole, which has reared its head again. But you're the only person that's ever made any money. I personally know, because you told us that story last time you came on, but Do you sense that it's got elements of the internet just before the bust of the internet, and it's also got elements of meme coin and bit exchanges and that whole crowd as well?
So here's the thing with Bitcoin and crypto, and I'm not super into it, but I did buy some early just because, just to take a flyer. And I, as you said, I made more money than I thought I would, almost as much money as I did selling my company. So the thing with crypto,
it's a bit of money, is it?
It was bizarre. Hard work, luck, and skill, right? So with crypto,
so what were you telling me? I should forget about building companies and just punter on Bitcoin.
I couldn't have bought the Bitcoin if I hadn't sold the company. No. That's why. So the thing is with crypto is there really still to this day is like there is not a great use case that everybody needs it. Like there's not, my mom and dad are 80 years old. They don't need to know about crypto at all. Most people just don't. And that's the bottom line. AI. I mean, my brother runs an electrical construction firm. And he doesn't own any crypto, doesn't need to. It's not, there's just no need. There's no pull. I showed him ChatGPT when it came out, you know, 18 months ago or whatever. And he uses it daily now. He's just an everyday dude who runs a construction firm. And he's like, this is incredible. So the use case is there. So Jonathan, I think crypto is very different than the early days of crypto, very different than early days of the internet. You know what I mean? I see those two as crypto was so much hype. The internet was a bunch of hype, if you remember.
Yeah, but there was something to it.
There was something to it. But remember when it crashed, it got overhyped and we had pets.com selling dog bags of dog food and we had stupid, crazy stuff happening and Kozmo.com with a K, K-O-Z-M-O, which was the delivery service that went out of business. But then we had DoorDash and Uber Eats and Instacart, and I use all those things, right? So they were too early. And when the crash happened in 2000 and 2001, people said the internet's done, right? By people, it was journalists trying to get views and clicks. It's done. It's done. It's hype. And then guess what happened? It wasn't hype. The internet has absolutely changed our everyday life. I think AI and let's say chat interfaces and generative AI and AI that categorizes all the stuff we're using it for, I think there's absolutely a hype cycle. There's way too much money being pumped in by venture capitalists. And a bunch of that is going to crash, but there still is a massive, massive use case. And, you know, you see it through, the number is OpenAI's revenue based on people paying the subscriptions. How many people are actually paying and sticking around? It's a lot. I mean, and they should be charging more than $20 a month, by the way. I would pay so much more. I mean, there's a lot there. But it's going to stick around. And I keep saying, ignore at your peril. You know, it's especially if you're an entrepreneur, you need to know, hey, do I need to integrate AI into my product itself? Maybe, maybe not, but at least evaluate. Do you need to integrate it into your kind of day-to-day operations and workflows and software development? Yeah, I don't see that there's just no argument there.
Right. Back over to you, Kirk, for the next formal question.
Well, we kind of segue perfect with your comment. Rob, you said you thought $20 was way too small to charge for AI, right? $20 a month. So if we talk about your ideas on pricing strategies and how disastrous they are, again, we're referring to another episode from your podcast, but talk to me a little bit about the freemium pricing model, and then where you think the value of products really falls.
Mm. Yeah. So here's the counterintuitive thing, or the, I don't know, maybe the thing most people don't know about me. Freemium is amazing. I love freemium. The problem is it doesn't work most of the time. And what I don't love is the kind of myth around it that I see. Usually it's on Reddit or on X Twitter, of just everybody launching with freemium because that's what OpenAI does, right? Or that's what Facebook did, or that's what, you know, Reddit or who else, like Dropbox is a famous freemium. If you have $100 million in the bank of venture capital funding, then go try freemium. And if you don't, then don't do it. Usually that's kind of my default. There are bootstrappers who make freemium work. It is just specifically with SaaS. I'm not talking about WordPress yet. I know, you know, we may want to get there because it is the default really in WordPress. And so if you don't do it, I think that'd be a challenge. But freemium is a distribution strategy. It's a marketing strategy. It's not a pricing strategy. And I believe Patrick Campbell from ProfitWell came up with that idea, but it totally is. It's not about price. It's about how do I get this thing into people's hands such that I can then own the lead until they decide to convert. And there's four things that need to be in place in order for freemium to work. You can listen to the podcast. I won't go through them all here, but one of the big ones is that people don't think about or don't... is virality. If you don't have some type of viral loop, meaning that everyone who signs up winds up telling someone else about it. And usually this, you know, a good example is SavvyCal, right? I mean, this is Derek Reimer, my Drip co-founder. He built a competitor to Calendly. Okay. So SavvyCal has a viral loop because when I sign up for SavvyCal and I send the two of you my link to book me, you're like, oh, hey, what's this thing? Click through. Hey, powered by SavvyCal. That's interesting viral loop. It's not the strongest viral loop, but it is a viral loop, right? If you don't have that, I really don't think I've ever seen freemium work without that. And so people just do it. It's cargo culting. Well, if the big company did it, it worked, I should do it too. Rather than saying, why did it work? And in what instances? Well, you need 100 million in the bank or 5 million in the bank. You know, you need some money in the bank to do freemium usually.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what are the other criteria?
I think about freemium models that I experience in the WordPress space, and one very directly, because I work directly with the Lifter LMS folks. That's a freemium model. But Lifter's freemium product is potent. It works. You can use it. Like it's a full thing on its own. And then the add-ons give you features for expansion and growth and all those things. A lot of the freemium things that I see in the WordPress space, I think to your point, is to try and hit that. It's obvious that it's for distribution. It's obvious they just want space in your plugins list. And the freemium model really doesn't do a full example of anything you need. You got to buy something to make it function or work or do what's purported to be the feature of the product.
Right. And that's, look, open source is a kind of a different conversation. Like there's approximately zero open source SaaS companies, right? There are a few, but there's not many. And so open source itself, which doesn't imply it has to be free, but really it does, right? I mean, open source stuff is free. That almost forces a type of freemium. Like if you came into WordPress and tried to not, if I had a plugin or a theme, didn't do some type of freemium, it would just be really counterintuitive. But as a result, it shrinks the market. All right. What if WordPress Core and all the plugins, what if there was no freemium? It was all 7-day trial. Let's just hypothetically, obviously that you can't go back and change it, but at the scale it's at now, if it wasn't free, if everything was charged for, it would be the market would be so much. I mean, it'd be billions and tens of billions of dollars larger than it is right now. There would just be more money in it. It would be easier to build a business. Especially as a small operator, right? There's a reason that SaaS and, there's a reason that a lot of the small WordPress, I know a bunch of bootstrappers that do WordPress, they struggle to charge more than $100 a year, $200 a year. Like it's inexpensive, right? 10, 20 a month, maybe if they can charge monthly. It is hard, I believe it's harder to build a business. And in fact, when we started MicroConf, when we started getting attendees, we're like, oh, you have WordPress plugins, you have SaaS, you have mobile apps, there was all this stuff because it was 2011. I didn't know which of those was the best business, and I didn't know which of them would become the big thing. And SaaS did. And it's because you can charge a lot. It's because, the market hasn't been shrunk to the point where it's like, oh, I can only get maybe 10% of the value that otherwise I could. And I do, WordPress is like that because it's open source. Now, that's a good thing as well. It's good that it's open source. It wouldn't be as big as it is without being open source, but it's a headwind if you're a bootstrapped entrepreneur trying to build a business in it, if I'm being honest. And I'm a guy, I've owned stuff in the WordPress space. So like, I'm not against it, right? I think WordPress is amazing. And I still use it for the podcast website. And I was an early investor in WP Engine. You know, there's all this, I have a history with it, but it's tough. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, there's a great use case right now that we see in real time, where there's a WooCommerce developer that is now branching out into Shopify development. And she's being very transparent about the work. And she's like, yeah, the margins are great. You know, there is more funding. There's more money. People are more apt to purchase, you know, rather than just try to manipulate a piece of code for free. And it's a very interesting mindset, I think, to look at.
Yeah, I've got some views. I don't really totally agree with Robert, but I'm going to leave my views to the second half of the show. We've had a great discussion so far, but we're going to go for our middle break and we will be back in a few moments.
Tired of hosting providers that can't handle high traffic loads? Conversio is here to help. Our platform can handle any amount of traffic, all without slowdown or crashing. With immediate Slack support, performance optimization, and a team that thrives on resolving technical challenges, your e-commerce business is in safe hands. Learn more about Convessio at convessio.com.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Lifter LMS, the leading learning management system solution for WordPress. If you or your client are creating any kind of online course, training-based membership website, or any type of e-learning project, Lifter LMS is the most secure, stable, well-supported solution on the market. Go to lifterlms.com and save 20% at checkout with coupon code podcast20. That's podcast20. Enjoy the rest of your show.
We're coming back, folks. We've had a great discussion with a friend of the show, Rob Rowling. It's always a blessing to have him on the show. We always have interesting discussions. Before we go into the second half of the show, I just want to point out, if you're a freelance or a power user and you're looking for a great hosting provider that provides all the best plugins, the best WordPress technology, so you don't have to have arguments with your clients about buying all the right plugins for the project, plus really powerful, secure hosting, why don't you look at building something with WP Tonic? We've got some great deals for you, the freelancer power user. You can find more by going over to wp-tonic.com/partners, wp-tonic.com/partners. And we love to build something special together. Well, I see where you're coming from, and Rob, but I think one of the problems with the pricing was linked to the foundations of WordPress as a free blogging platform that basically got traction because it replaced a paid blogging platform that was getting into trouble. I've got the name of it. It was so long ago. Do you remember it, Rob, the name of it? I can't.
Blogspot? Pardon? Was it like Blogger or Blogspot?
No, it was called something else, actually. Typo or something. Something like that.
I remember this. Typefully? Yeah.
Something like that, wasn't it? It was so long ago, Rob. I'm ancient. And I think it's traditions, but I think... I do know some plugin providers that are providing more specialized services, especially to the business-to-business. One comes to mind is WP Fusion, and there's a couple of others that are charging reasonable amounts of money, and there are some other plugins. I think it really depends on your target audience. Also, I think you're slightly discounting. You might have to charge a little bit less depending on the broadness of your market selection. But, you know, being part of the WordPress community ecosystem, you're saving a lot of time and energy when you are placing your product, then having to go out there and actually market. Which, you know, I had last time I interviewed Jason with WP Engine, he told me it took him 3 years to get 300 clients. And this is a person technically and got the marketing chops. He's a very honest individual. So it took him 3 years with WP Engine to get that first 300 clients. But I think a lot of the problems with WordPress is its historic placement. And I think in the business world, there's a lot of clients that got legacy software that's now coming up for redundancy. And when they look at the costs and lock-in of buying bespoke custom software solutions, and then they look at a hybrid solution of maybe looking at WordPress, It's more attractive when they look at the pricing of a full customized locked-in bespoke solution. Am I making any sense, Rob?
Yeah. Yeah, you're saying that for like custom line of business in-house software, whether it's managing content management system for their website or other stuff, that by building on WordPress is better or is can be less expensive and or just they have more control because it's open source.
Yeah, but you're trying to build something totally, you know, you can use the core, the interface, other elements.
Yeah.
But then you can add, you can customize it, but you're not fully locked into a fully bespoke solution. And deal with that ego of those developers, Rob.
Yeah, think about that.
Yeah.
I think of it more, see, I'm a product person, right? I stopped doing consulting and freelancing back in 2008. That was the last time I did it. And what you're talking about is going in and doing a consulting engagement, right? And building something out for someone. And in that respect, I think you're correct. But if I were to be deciding, should I build a plugin or theme business, or do I want to build a SaaS, I would obviously go towards SaaS because I believe it's a better business model.
Yeah, over to you, Kurt.
Well, it looks like I get to jump back into another episode of your podcast. And the one that was titled Six Lessons from My Most Successful Investments in B2B SaaS. You outlined a lot of important principles for building a successful SaaS business. So I was hoping that you could share with us, you know, just some of the insights with the listeners of this show.
Yeah, for sure. I have a couple bonus ones, actually. I mentioned them in another place, but I did not mention them in that particular YouTube.
You get 10 stars for the bonus.
Very nice.
We're going to attempt the book for sure.
Yeah.
Very cool. So there's an interesting thing, a pattern we've seen. So across Tiny Seed, we're a startup accelerator for SaaS companies, ambitious SaaS founders. And we've invested in 192 SaaS companies. And one of the patterns, that's where I pulled all these learnings. I think I put 6 in that video and then I had like 8 more, 9 more that I put in the podcast. But one of the ones that struck me as really interesting is that horizontal SaaS, meaning SavvyCal is a good example of that, right? Anybody can use it, any industry, any business, versus we have invested in a lot of vertical SaaS. So vertical SaaS example would be Gymdesk. That's a company of ours that sold recently, a portfolio company. And Gymdesk is an operating system for your gym, martial arts dojo, fitness studio. You know, it does all the stuff, soup to nuts. And what we've seen is that in general, the horizontal plays face headwinds, especially in the early days. If they get traction, great. They get to 500,000, they get to 1 million, and then they start to really see headwinds and they plateau more often. And they have higher churn in general than our vertical plays. That just the numbers.
Can you quickly explain the two concepts to the audience?
Yeah. Horizontal is just means it's across any industry. And then vertical means you build software for exactly a single industry. Now there's a third time. This is the other thing that I coined this term last year because I started realizing we have invested in like a company called Code Submit. And what it is it's for HR managers to help evaluate developers. So it's like coding challenges and quizzes and this and that. That's horizontal technically because any company can use it in their HR. But it's different than SavvyCal. Like it's different horizontal. And I was like, what's different about it? Well, what's different is that it targets a particular role or title at a company. So I was like asking ChatGPT, what should I call this? It's a role-based and title-based. And these are all awful monikers, right? So eventually, since vertical and horizontal, I came up with orthogonal. And the reason is because it is horizontal, but orthogonal, meaning it only hits one piece of it. Basically, it's role-based or title-based SaaS that operates and behaves more like vertical SaaS in terms of the net negative churn is easier to get there. You know who to market to. You know who to cold outreach to. Like it is a lot easier than when you plateau at 1 million or 1.5 million and you're horizontal. What do you do? You know, it's like really hard to get around that versus if you're, orthogonal or vertical. I think it is easier actually. It's easier to know what the next steps are to try to get out of a plateau.
Well, it's kind of akin to, you know, if you listen to the Membership Machine show with Jonathan, a topic that's common is, you know your niche or know your avatar, know your audience, right? And so instead of trying to make a,
a membership or learning project that is, you know, to your point, horizontal and good for everybody. It's like, if it's good for everybody, it's good for nobody, right? That's like, so if the more that you can niche into something, the more you can target your audience and find success. But it's interesting that software is like that. So like, if I had a CRM tool for service managers in the automotive field, that would be like, bam, 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 like very direct. And you think that would probably be stronger than, say, a CRM tool for any manager?
Yeah, I do. Especially to start with. And here's the thing. There's, you know, venture dollars go into very big markets. And so as a result, they get really crowded. And venture-backed companies can lose money for a very long time. And they can outspend you. It doesn't mean they'll win, but it just, there's headwinds there. If you start with a vertical, you can, and you get a lot of traction. We have seen a number of companies then add another vertical. You can do that if eventually you plateau because you've tapped out the entire vertical. It's extremely rare to do that, but there are some that are so small.
So you hit an interesting point that's always been a kind of a thought for me. When you say add another vertical, so like I said, service managers in the automotive business. So they might say service managers in the marine business, service managers in the motorcycle business. Like you could just keep adding those on. How many people do you feel in the software space that you're in SaaS take their success almost for granted? Like they think they've topped out a vertical, but in reality, they still have half that vertical to go. Like do they abandon too early and get out too early and miss the opportunity, or do they get impatient?
Yeah, they get impatient, or they say, well, nothing I'm doing is working to generate more customers. So therefore, I must have tapped the entire market out. And the answer is almost never. If you've tapped the market out, you tend to know. Like we've invested in a company called Senior Place, and they are SaaS for senior placement agents, which are like realtors for senior living.
I thought you had said Senior Place.
Senior Place. Senior Place. Anyways,
I don't retire at the least, but
that would be a good SaaS. Apply tinyc.com/apply if you start that business. But anyway, Senior Place, they have a very small market and they know it. There's like, I forget what the number is. I think it's 3,000 senior placement agents in the country. And they know that's a market. So they've been from day one, they're like, they have to charge quite a bit of money to make it worthwhile. And they know they're going to top out at, you know, whatever. They haven't hit it yet, but they know that. And so they've already started being like, all right, so do we offer more stuff, more products, more add-ons, more whatever to this existing audience that we already have, the existing customer base, or do we add a second vertical? That's usually the decision.
So just one more follow-up and then I'll pass it over to Jonathan. In those examples that you're giving, do you find it is more financially advantageous to add services to the existing vertical market, or do you find it more advantageous to graft on another vertical market to the same product?
I mean, probably depends. Let me think. I think it depends, but I would tend to lean, all things being equal, it would be nice to not have to build a bunch of new stuff. You don't want to build a bunch of new stuff if possible. And so if you have this product for one vertical and it's not a ton of work to go to the second, then great. Code base stays generally the same. You change some whatevers, add a little feature here and there. Now you do then have to start the marketing engine, right? And so if you've only been doing realtors and now you want to do mortgage brokers, you probably have a little bit of reach in there, but you do have to extend it. So I think my it depends is, with the caveat of, it depends on if you think that marketing into that new vertical is going to be harder than building eventually a second product or a bunch of add-ons for your existing one, and if that's feasible, you know, and if you have ideas for that, like you may not, right? So that's the strategy call. If I were with a founder, we'd spend 45 minutes just spitballing this. Well, how long do you think it'll take? What ideas do we have? You know, you have to have a hypothesis for each of these, and that would be a decision. It's a complicated decision in the end.
Yeah. Jonathan?
Yeah, I just want to touch something. I think a lot of people don't really understand. Well, I wonder why you've stuck with Tiny Seed, really, because it's not the traditional investment model, is it? I presume you do it because you're not totally interested in money. I think the money gives you freedom and gives you you and your family choices. But I don't think, because the reason why I assume this, because people don't really understand the traditional venture capitalist model, which is, you know, one in 10 of their investments will get big. And the actual business model is to find really extreme wacko founders that are half crazy but got a big idea, and you punt with them. And as long as you think they've got some chance, of those 10, one might get big and you might get a trade sale of some of the others. So they break even, but you're looking for that real big idea and that real semi-crazed wacko founder. Bootstrap investing is about minimizing risk, you know, which is the normal model of business, you know. And if you've got any sense, you go into businesses and you attempt to reduce your risk, because business tends to have a very high failure rate. And so really it's about finding a business model that reduces your risk. But venture capital is a totally different business model, isn't it? Which I still think a lot of people don't understand that, do they? But why have you stuck in the bootstrap? Because you could have gone, you're quite capable of going the traditional route. I just wondered why you chose to stay in the tiny seed area.
Yeah, it's because there's a gap in the market and we're the only one filling it. And there's potential here in the long term to make money on these investments. In the near term, I mean, what people don't understand about venture capital, I wouldn't be doing tiny seed if I hadn't already had the big exit with Drip, because I take a salary and that's it. All the money, any of the big returns that you think about are all down the line, because you have to return all your investor money. We've raised $42 million that we've invested into companies. We take out a management fee, of course, but then we invested in these companies. We have to return $42 million before we get a dime. We being the owners of Tiny Seed. So that's years down the line. It's at least 10 years from our first investment until any type of real, like, significant money comes back. To your point, the reason I've stuck with it though is because I really do believe, I believe in what we're doing, and I think it has the potential not only to, like, continue to catalyze this ecosystem, because my mission in life is to multiply the world's population of independent, self-sustaining startups. All right, that's what I want to do. That's the rest of my life. That's all my books. That's MicroConf. That's Tiny Seed. That's the podcast. That's YouTube. And Tiny Seed is a big part of being able to do that. Now, I have to justify everything I do. It just in my head, usually money is involved. I have hobbies that don't involve money, but if I want to be doing something professionally day to day and spending a lot of time and kind of grinding, I do need there to be the potential to make the money. And to your point, Jonathan, you know, why are we raising our third, technically fourth fund right now to invest in more Tiny Seed companies? Because early results are really promising. Like I forget which fund it is, Anar knows all this, but I think fund one is in the top 5%, maybe 4% of funds of its vintage. In terms of performance, that's across all venture capital. There's your Carta or AngelList numbers. I forget who, but really, really good early performance. And SaaS specifically sells at really high multiples. We don't need outlier billion-dollar outcomes. We can have folks who sell for 20 million, 30 million, 40 million, and our model works such that eventually, as more companies sell, will provide great returns. When I say we're early, 192 investments, I believe 4% of those, maybe 5, somewhere between 4 and 5, have either gone to zero or kind of sold where we got 1x back, like we got our money back. And then another maybe 2 or 3% have sold for, like, you know, 7-8 figures, like good outcomes where we make a return. That's it. So across our whole portfolio, and we wrote our first checks in 2019, 6 years ago, it's only like 6%, 7% of companies no longer in operation. It's really small, right? So SaaS is a long game. And so kind of I knew from the start we'd have to be in it for a while in order to really prove it out.
Right, thanks. Over to you, Kurt.
Well, that bumps us to our AI question, which is kind of an extension of that second question, right? But you had mentioned ChatGPT and Cursor and a couple of others. But in the day-to-day, in you know, the Rob Walling world, what AI tools are you personally using to help you in business?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, My team uses Pod Squeeze, which we upload a podcast episode and it writes show first draft, of course. We human edit them, but it summarizes, writes show notes, puts all the timestamps in, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite good. It saves us a significant amount of time. Of course, we all use ChatGPT, but my team, a lot of folks on my team use Poe. poe.com, which allows you to switch between ChatGPT. It's still $20 a month. This is like giving away a dollar to get 50 cents back, is what I think. I don't know, but like Poe allows you to just switch to Claude right in your interface and switch to OpenAI or ChatGPT and switch to all these different models. Now, I don't actually use Poe because I've found I like ChatGPT. It's fine. It works for what I need. I don't use it so intensely. I use ChatGPT for a lot, though, not just searches, but for helping me brainstorm, refine ideas. I use it as I use it to get me halfway to like a YouTube outline. I say, pretend you're Rob Walling. Outline this video with this title. Try to make it non-generic. Try to make it Rob-specific stuff, and it'll spit it out, and it usually gets me 50, 70% of the way. At least their ideas, and oftentimes there's a couple ideas in there. I'm like, I wouldn't have thought of that. That's cool. I'll use that in the video.
Yeah. And the advantage of that is that you've got published books that it can refer to too, right? In the voice of Rob Walling and all that.
Podcasts, YouTube, all of that. It pulls.
Yeah. So you've got that persona that you can nail into. Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned the Poe. I use a very similar strategy with a tool called Magi, which is a AI service, but it's got 6 or 7 different tools that you can just live switch to. So it's got Claude and ChatGPT and Llama and all that. And you can just, okay, I want to do this. And I find, as weird as it is, I don't consider myself an expert in AI, but boy, it sure is nice to be able to be in one screen and be able to pop into the different tools and do different things.
Yeah. Big time.
Yeah, that's sweet.
Well, I've got a suite of tools because it's helped with my dyslexia, Rob. If only I had this 15 years ago. I'm actually not here, Rob. It's actually artificial intelligence.
I can see that. You're being so nice today. I was like, what's up with Jonathan? And it's called AI.
On to our next question. So will you be able to stay on or do you have to be off at the hour or can you spend another 10 minutes with us?
I'm looking. I can spend another 10 minutes.
Yeah, so we have some bonus content. Kurt's got to be off before the hour because he's got another commitment. But if you had your own time machine, you could go back to the start of your career and tell yourself one thing, a little bit of advice to yourself, apart from not coming back on this podcast, Rob. You can't tell yourself that. But anything else, you know, anything comes to mind, some little hint or nudge that you could have told yourself, Rob?
Younger Rob, be less scared. Be less anxious. Be less worried about all this. Ship faster. Make more mistakes. Don't be afraid to fail, move quickly. Because I was in my head for years and years and years, and it cost me years and years and years, not only of stress, but I just moved slow because I was hesitant about a bunch of things. And it's a pattern we see across our founders, the ones who really move quickly and are less afraid of failing. It doesn't mean they're not impacted by failure, but they just ship a lot of stuff pretty quickly and they kind of take risks. That's what I wish I was doing from the start.
I totally agree with you, but on one proviso, I just wanted to see if you've noticed this. I'm old now, but I just don't accept it. I'm still young at heart. I'm actually fitter. I had a real serious health scare about 3 years ago, and I've lost over 120 pounds, Rob.
Good for you.
And I exercise vigorously every day, and I've mostly given up on meat. That was shock, Kirk. You can't cope with that. But I've noticed with Gen Z and millennials, and I don't know what the next one is, they seem to apply what you said to personal relationships as well. And I find that a little bit disturbing because obviously if you've got friends that do something really appalling and they turn out not to be people that you think they should be, you obviously got to drop them. But normally, I have about half a dozen friends and they can totally rely on me. I have a lot of acquaintances, but I have about half a dozen really close friends. But I find with a lot of people, they apply what you've said about your business. You know, you like to, you would have stopped worrying so much and moved to the next. They seem to apply that to their personal relationships and people in general. How would you respond? Do you think I'm onto something, or am I just an old geezer romanticizing about the past?
I don't think I can comment on whether it's a generational or whatever. What I will say is, to be clear about what I said, I meant it with certainly for business, as you've said, but also there's just a list of things that I think are implicit in any comment like that, which is be moral, be ethical, don't hurt your fellow humans, be good to the other people. You know what I mean? Like, so when I say, hey, ship faster.
Do you think you can be an effective business individual with those principles? Well,
I am. Yes, you can. And I know several. I mean, we're invested in a bunch of tiny seed founders, and the vast majority of them are good people. Do I know? I mean, I could start naming. Jason Cohen's a great guy. Heaton Shaw's a great guy. You know, I know decamillionaires. I know centimillionaires that are good people, and I know some that aren't. Right? It's a mix. I think people who do that, who are dismissive of other people's feelings, or who don't include the thought of, hey, I might be hurting this person or these people in their calculus, I don't hang around with those people.
No, I agree with you. I think this propaganda that you've got to be a certain type of individual, I think it can be very effective, but I also think it suits the personality of that individual to have that attitude around business. You know, it's a mixture of, it suits their personal biology, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's easier to make money or to be successful if you screw everybody over in the short term, probably. In the long term, I think it comes back to bite you. But do I think that's worth it? No, because I have a code of morals and ethics that I'm going to live by, you know, and I can do that to people. And I think I believe in humanity. I think generally most people feel that way, though not all.
Yeah. All right, we're going to wrap it up. Kurt's got to go off to his other engagement. So, Kurt, what's the best way for people to find out more about you and what you're up to, Kurt?
For business, anything that's Mañana No Más. We're Mañana No Más on X, on Facebook, and of course, mañananomás.com. And if you want to make a personal connection, just connect through LinkedIn. I'm on there almost every day.
And Rob, what's the best way to find out about what you're up to and your latest thoughts on SaaS and business in general?
And his latest book.
Yeah.
Latest book, Exit.
Which we're going to be discussing in the bonus content in a bit more detail.
Now available on Amazon, Exit Strategy. Keep up with me. I put out free content every week. So youtube.com/microconf. That you'll see a video about every 14 days. And then Startups for the Rest of Us, either .com or type that into Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever greater podcasts are served. And I'm on episode 760 something. And that comes out every week like clockwork since 2010.
Yeah. We're going to ramp up the podcast of the show. I've got a question. I've had some thinking. I know this is going to be a big surprise to your tribe. I've been thinking about SaaS and AI, and I've got some ideas which I'm going to put to Rob, and he's going to tell me that I'm a lunatic. But he knows that anyway. He's worked out, and his wife told him I was a lunatic anyway. But I'm a decent lunatic. I know. I can't be totally wacko because I know I'm a wacko, don't I, Rob? So there we go. He shugs. He doesn't care. But you'll be able to watch the podcast and the bonus content on the WP Tonic YouTube channel. And think about subscribing. I'm always putting new content around on the channel every week. And we will be back next week with a great guest interview. We'll see you soon, folks. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. Why not visit the Mastermind Facebook group? And also, to keep up with the latest news, click wp-tonic.com/newsletter. We'll see you next time.